food is a huge part of every aspect of Thai culture, from births to deaths, every kind of milestone along the way. You know, even if you go swimming at the ocean, you see people out in the water with food in their hands while they're swimming.
You're listening to Pubcast Worldwide.
Greetings, thirsty listeners, and welcome to this episode of Pubcast Worldwide, the podcast where we get to know interesting people around the world, chatting with them over beers, cocktails, and other libations at the coolest pubs, bars, and breweries on the planet. I'm your host, Chris Lukey, a Thai food novice, serial event planner, and someone that likes to keep it weird in Portland every once in a while. We've got a big interview today with Andy Ricker from Portland's Pock Pock. And this is very likely not the first time you've heard of this guy. But if you don't know anything about Andy Ricker, here's a quick primer. He is an absolute expert when it comes to authentic Thai and Southeast Asian cuisine. He's always perfecting his craft, and it shows in his work and accolades. Aside from his plethora of restaurants across Portland and New York City, he's been featured on Food Network, Travel Channel, his own Vice documentary, and he's even written a couple of books. So, what are the three things that you're going to get from today's episode? First, you'll hear Andy's story leading up to his first restaurant, Pock Pock, and how his experiences traveling, working in restaurants, and even painting houses influenced his passion for Thai food. Since we haven't done an episode of this show in Thailand yet, this is about the closest we've got to that so far. Second, I mentioned he's been on a couple travel shows. We'll talk about his experiences with Anthony Bourdain on Parts Unknown, his time with Guy Fieri on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. I think you'll dig this because he shares some of the realities behind these guys and these shows. Beyond food and travel TV, we talk music, hear a couple of Andy's travel stories, so hopefully you feel like you've gotten to know Andy by the end of this episode. Third, and finally, we discuss Andy's new book, The Drinking Food of Thailand, his second cookbook, which dropped right before the recording of this episode in December 2017. As you might guess, the title is pretty direct. It focuses on food that goes with a night of drinking. In Thailand, these are snacky dishes that, as Andy describes them, are chewy, crunchy, spicy, sour. Having finally gotten a chance to page through it, the photography is incredible as well. It's very much in the Ricker aesthetic, and I definitely recommend you check it out. Again, that's The Drinking Food of Thailand. And while we talk a ton about Southeast Asia, we actually met up in Andy's home base of Portland, Oregon for this recording. When I asked for a spot that he wanted to do it, he was very quick to respond with Reel 'Em In. This is like a classic Portland dive bar. I'll let Andy really take care of the description as we jump into the episode, but it definitely had some funky elements to it. Great spot. Also, while I don't think it'll be distracting, the background noise is a bit more present than in other episodes. However, I would say have some fun with that, because you might even be able to play a little Name That Tune at one point. If you hear a tune you like, why not make mention of it and leave a comment of it over at pubcastworldwide.com. All right, I'm getting thirsty for a conversation, and hopefully you are too. So grab a bottle of Chong beer, go flag down a tuk-tuk, and make your way over to Reel 'Em In so we can meet up with Chef Andy Ricker.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for being on the show, Andy.
My pleasure.
So where are we at right now? Describe the setting.
So this is the Reel 'Em In, which has been voted the best dive bar in the world
yeah.
in the past. Google it up, the Reel 'Em In. And this place has been a dive bar since its inception, as far as I can tell. It's undergone, since I've lived in Portland, it's undergone a couple of changes of hands, but I don't think they've taken anything away.
Yeah,
they may have added some shelves here and there, but this place is famous for cheap beer, huge shots,
uh-huh.
and broasted chicken.
That's what I've heard.
Massive deep fried chicken, and even more important than that, JoJo's.
Okay. Oh yeah,
JoJo's.
Those are like deep fried potato wedges. Am I making that up?
That's correct. Yeah. So they're battered deep fried potato wedges, and this place has basically it has a very storied past. Mm-hmm. There's usually only one bartender, one employee at a time working here, and they just kind of cover the whole place. Order at the bar, low ceilinged, covered with chalk. There used to be a fishing theme here, as you might tell by the name, that the previous owner was a avid fisherman. The current owner might be, but I'm not sure about that.
Got it.
I have seen everything here from friends falling off the back of the bar stool to me almost falling off the back of the bar stool.
All right.
To, like, saw Red Fang played here one night for Dwayne Sorensen's birthday. The founder of Stumptown.
So this is kind of a small spot. Where is the band set up here?
Right there. They just move the pool table. The pool table gets moved out of the way, and the band sets up. That's the only time I've ever seen a band here.
Got it.
But,
okay.
You know, this place is, I've been here with every kind of person you can imagine has been. I don't know who the most famous person that's been in here, but it's somebody far famous than both of us.
Sure. Well, thank you for adding me to that list, I suppose, despite the fact that I currently carry no fame. And what are we drinking here? I feel like what we've got in front of us is very appropriate for a dive bar like this.
This is my go-to domestic beer, Rolling Rock. I grew up on the East Coast, Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
This is Latrobe, PA's finest. One of the beers you could get when I was growing up in Vermont, you could get Rolling Rock in a bar bottle. You could get Bud in a bar bottle.
Yeah.
That was kind of it. Grew up drinking it, still drink it.
I couldn't imagine really pairing like a spot like this with anything, you know, too much more exotic than Rolling Rock.
But it's Portland, right? So they have plenty of local beers here and stuff, and probably even some locally distilled whiskeys and stuff.
Yeah. I've always said there's a time and place for a macro brew, though, and this feels like the spot.
This is it, yeah.
But I've got to ask you, if we were in Thailand right now, what would we be drinking?
Well, first of all, there's very few places in Thailand that look that have the same vibe as this, but if we were in an establishment that was of similar social strata, we'd probably be drinking rice whiskey, Lao Tong, they call it, Lao Khao, white whiskey or herbal whiskey, and then probably just either a Leo or a Sing beer or Chang or something like that.
Yep.
On ice.
That sounds about right. I've only been to Thailand once so far, but I had plenty of Chang and plenty of Chang overs while I was there, as I understand they call them. Well, for those of you listening today, I'm excited to introduce our guest. He is certainly someone that is no stranger to the spotlight, a two-time James Beard Award winner. You've probably seen him on Parts Unknown with Anthony Bourdain, maybe his Vice documentary, or at the very least, eaten at one of his restaurants across Portland or New York City. I'm here with Andy Ricker from the Pock Pock Empire. I'm curious, you know, to set some context for folks that don't necessarily know you, can you take us back to the beginning? Like, what's the story behind how you got started in Thai cuisine? Like, what was your background before Pock Pock?
That's two big questions there, because I'm kind of old and I've been around for a while, so I've got a lot of different histories. Right before Pock Pock, I was a house painter. But before that, I had spent most of my career working adult life as a cook or a waiter or a bartender or a restaurant manager, various different places around the world, different scenarios, everything from like kind of like a Hooters-inspired place in Australia all the way up to like some very, very fancy fine dining places. Right before I opened the restaurant, I had been a house painter for about 9 years.
Okay.
House painting contractor. And the way that I got into Thai food was by traveling. I've been going to Thailand since the first trip was 1986 or 87. I think it might have been 87. I went again in 92. And that was where it really kicked off, was 1992. So kind of been fucking around with Thai food for about 25 years.
So what attracts you to Northern Thai culture and Thai culture in general?
Well, Thai culture in general is it's something that I've been around for a long time and I feel comfortable around it. I don't profess to fully understand what's going on all the time, but I've got a pretty good grip on it and it's comfortable to me. It's very, on the surface, it's pretty laid back, very friendly, playful, but also I think the thing that is really kind of drew me to it in a lot of ways was the fact that all Thai people are foodies.
Okay.
In one way, if you want to call it. I hate the word foodies, but Thai people spend a lot of time thinking about planning for eating food.
Sure.
Food is a huge part of every aspect of Thai culture, from births to deaths, every kind of milestone along the way, Buddhist holidays, harvest rituals, all that kind of stuff. There's always food involved. You know, even if you go swimming at the ocean, you see people out in the water with food in their hands while they're swimming. So it's very food-centric. People think about it a lot. Mm-hmm. And there's good reason. Right? The food in Thailand is fantastic. Some of the best in the world, in my opinion. So that's at least got to be part of it. Also, it's a very, like, if you're poor, like I was when I first started traveling, you can stay there for long periods of time because it's not that expensive to be there. So
right.
There's also, you know, there's oceans, beaches, mountains, big cities, interesting people. It's just, it's a fascinating country, and it's easy to travel around in. So it was just, it kind of like welcomed me in a way.
Well, you know, one thing that I think is unique about what you do with Pock Pock in your restaurants is you have an extreme attention to detail and doing things the way they essentially do it in Thailand versus the Americanized version of what we see as pad Thai or Thai food. What would you say is something that most people don't grasp right off the bat about Thai culture and Thai cuisine?
Well, the first thing I would say that they don't grasp is that the food that you eat in Thailand is in America at a Thai restaurant is not Americanized. Mm-hmm. It's Thai-ified. It is food that Thai people have figured out how to cook using the ingredients they have available to them that most closely mimic what they understand to be Thai food. Mm-hmm. And you look at any cuisine that's involved in any kind of ethnic or national diaspora, Chinese or Mexican or Italian or Greek or whatever it is. You know, people, immigrants arrive in the country that they're going to go to, and the first thing they need to do is cook for themselves, right? So first thing they do is they try to cook for themselves, and often what they find out right away is that they're not in the right kind of climate to get the raw materials they need to make their own food. So they start making do with what's there, and then they try to find ways to get the food they want to them from wherever it is that they come from. And eventually they adapt the recipes to what's available, what they can get, and then once they've satisfied their own needs, opening restaurants and food businesses is one of the very few ways that an immigrant in a new country can do business for themselves. There's no barrier to entry at all.
Sure.
The only barrier is, can you get your shit together and get enough money to open the place? That's it. There's no other barriers. And then there's a certain cachet. If you're Chinese or Thai and you open up a restaurant, nobody's going to question your ability to do so.
Right.
Or your, are you a chef? They don't care. It's like you're a Thai person, you open a Thai restaurant, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Being able to make food for yourself is a good start, but then you have to make money. So you gotta sell to the people that are in the market. So once you've kind of exhausted your range with the people that are from your own culture, you gotta go outside of that. So that's where things start to become not altered, but adapted to the new climate you're in. So if you're in a place like New York where, you know, the vast majority of the people that come to your restaurant don't eat pork, if you open a Chinese restaurant on the Lower East Side and people don't eat pork, then you're not likely to put pork on the menu. Right. So what are you going to put on it? Well, everybody eats chicken, so why do we have chicken pad Thai? Because people eat chicken here more readily than they eat pork.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not that the Thai food here has become Americanized. It's that the people that have come here have adapted to the climate and the country that they're in and have found a way to make a living, to make the food that tastes good to them. And that's what you end up with. So I think that's a one common misconception. It's people, the Thai food in America is Americanized. And it's not. It's Thai people cooking using the ingredients they have in front of them to make something that is Thai.
Absolutely. Like you said, it's the adaptability of Thai people coming to America, figuring out what works for our culture and bringing it in there. I'm going to flip that question a little bit now because you're obviously not Thai. What were you hoping to bring to the table when you first started Pock Pock?
Well, I mean, look, I'm in a unique position in that I am American, so I was born and raised here, and I have other skills. So, I wasn't opening a restaurant out of necessity, and I wasn't held down by my understanding of what my mom thought was right or my grandma thought was right because I don't have a Thai grandma or mom. So I was able to approach it in kind of a more kind of open-minded, scholarly way where I just kind of studied the food, figured out the things that I thought would work here, and, you know, learned over, and it took me a long time. It took me, 13 years of study before I felt comfortable enough to kind of pull the trigger and open a very simple, chicken shack. So, I think what was happening was I was going to Thailand, I was seeing all these dishes that I just wasn't seeing in restaurants here or at Thai friends' house. And that was partially because I was in a different region. I was up north and northeast and stuff like that. And a part of it was that, a lot of the stuff that you need to make those dishes isn't available here. Or it is available, but it's really expensive. And it makes it not viable from an economic standpoint to put it on the menu. Because maybe a little bit too esoteric for your average person who walks in out of the rain into a corner Thai shop. Looking for pad Thai, and they're presented with a dish that is, pork offal and blood and minced pork meat with this weird spice that nobody's heard of. And that's a pretty tough sell. At the very least, it's a huge risk for somebody who's just trying to make a living, But I wasn't faced with that same issue. I wasn't rich. But I made a calculated kind of gamble that I would be able to present the food in a way that people would have a better chance of understanding. That's the other advantage that I have. Mm-hmm. You know, this comes from being a white dude in America, is that I speak the language like a native. And I instead of writing a menu that just had the name of the dish and that's it, I could write a menu that had a detailed description of what was in the dish, how it was cooked, and put it into context for people to understand a little bit better. So it's a little easier to sell something. You can sell lab, right?
Yeah.
Dachom's lab mung, when you say Northern Thai minced pork and pork offal, quote, salad, unquote, with complex seasoning paste, chilies, bitter herbs, fried garlic, you know, and list what's in it and how it's prepared. That way, Americans who might not be familiar with the food could look at this and go, okay, I understand what's going on here, instead of just saying salt and pepper squid or larb.
Yeah.
Pork.
Right.
That was the main advantage I had here, was not that I was a better cook than the people who are cooking. It's just that I had better ability to tell people what they're about to eat. I think that's what I hope to do with that. Wasn't just like to make money, but to point out to people, look, there's all this other food that you can get in Thailand that you're not really seeing here that often, unless you're really lucky and you live in LA and you know where to go in LA, or you know where to go in New York. You know, check it out. And by the way, you know, this is common there. And the more people know about it, the more people ask for it, the more likely it is that other Thai restaurants will start selling it as well. I really wanted to contribute to the conversation around Thai food, which is something that I feel is one of the great cuisines of the world, and that has been sort of relegated, until very recently, it was relegated to kind of being cheap commodity takeout food.
Yeah.
And it just isn't. It's a fantastic cuisine.
And having done this for over 10 years now, have you seen that shift over time where there's a better appreciation for it than there was
Absolutely.
When you started?
Absolutely. You know, I can't take credit for it. I just hope that, you know, Pok's existence contributed to the opening up of that. You know, in the last 12 years, the internet happened.
Right. Yep.
You know,
yep.
And food, entertainment, TV happened.
Yeah.
Generation, you know, millennial happened.
Yep.
And there's just much more awareness around food and much more interest in travel, food travel, that kind of thing. That just wasn't happening, you know, 12, 15 years ago when I was planning this.
Sure.
There's also a lot more folks from that part of the world that are here now. So a lot of the product's a lot more available. A lot more restaurants have opened. And I think that a lot more Thai folks have been emboldened to open, you know, specific Isan restaurants, or specifically Central Thai royal style cuisine restaurants, or Southern Thai restaurants, or Northern Thai restaurants. You know, Pok is kind of like an early version of all that. And you know, I also remember one of the things that I stated early on was that I hope that I got put out of business eventually by Thai folks kind of going, you know, fuck it, we're just going to make all this stuff and make Pok irrelevant. You know, and I would welcome that, actually. I still would welcome it to become irrelevant. I'm sure there's some people out there who think that Pok never was relevant, let alone, you know, becoming irrelevant.
Well, I've got to give you credit, because as a kudos to you, I first came across Northern Thai cuisine because of you appearing on Anthony Bourdain. Like you were talking about TV, media, the internet, that popped up and certainly made my experiences over there more enjoyable, being able to track some of that down. I'm going to change the conversation a little bit. I want to talk about your approach to your work, because as I was researching for this, one word that came up from food critics, people you've worked with, even yourself, is obsessed. You have an extreme attention to detail around what you do, and I want to get your thoughts in your own mind, like, what are the pros and cons to having that level of interest in your work?
Well, I mean, the pros are that if you can pull it off, you get a really consistent product, and the cons are that you can drive yourself fucking crazy. My brain just works in a certain way. I don't know. I was a painting contractor for a long time, and I look back on that, and I remember there's this whole process I would go through before we painted the woodwork in a house. And, you know, I knew what it was, and it was step by step by step by step that I'd figured out over, you know, years of doing this. Like, oh, shit, if we don't do that, then when we spray it out, we get dust all over the place. So you know, we add these steps. And at some point, I was like, I wonder how many times we touch one piece of the wood, like on this whole window frame, how many times does each centimeter of this window frame get touched? And I, you know, I counted all the steps that we went through, and it came down to, like, I don't know, 15 times or something.
Wow.
You go into the place, you go through, and if it's new construction, you go through, and the first thing you do is you make sure there's any nail pops. You pop the nails back in. It's first time around. Second time around, you fill it. You put filler in it. Third time around, you sand the filler. Fourth time around, you go back, you blow it off with a compressed air, catch any things you missed. And then if you're spraying, you go around and you mask it. You mask everything off, and then you go through, and that's four or five. And then you spray primer, and then you sand every inch of it. And then you go back and you blow all the dust off again.
It's a very Mr. Miyagi-like element to what you're talking about.
And then you caulk. Yeah. Right? Once you caulk, you get done caulking, you clean and you tack cloth. And just get all the dust off of everything to accept a top coat. You go through, you make sure everything's clean, tight. You adjust your masking on everything. You mask everything off. And then you go spray the top coat on. You go through, make sure everything's all right. And then you come back the next day, you sand the first layer of top coat, lightly sand it. You go back, you tack cloth it again, and you finally spray it again. Once the trim has been finished, you go around and you mask the trim off and you paint the walls, right? And you go through a similar process. So that was how my brain worked. All was kind of like very detail-oriented, and I all start at the same corner of the room, and I go around in circles in the room. And kind of approached cooking the same way. What I realized early on was if I didn't have a systematic way of doing this, we weren't making Italian food, so I couldn't just turn around to a cook and say, make a mirepoix and get it going, and I want you to add a little bit of, what do you call that shit? I don't even remember. Salted pork back fat.
Couldn't tell you.
And then I want you to do this, and people could just do it, right? You know? This, I would say, you know, I need you to... pick the Chinese celery, and the first thing they say is, what's Chinese celery? You know what I mean?
Yep.
And then you got to show them how to pick it. So I had to kind of approach cooking the same way, both learning and teaching. Like, I had to learn very, very methodically. I had to go through and just watch very carefully how things were done, learn as much about the ingredients as I could before, you know, I would start cooking. And then I had to show other people how to do that, because in a restaurant, you don't do it by yourself. You got other people working for you. So it kind of, like, the way that my brain works, maybe it's, I don't know, that there's probably somebody out there, like some psychologist or something, who said, oh, yeah, you're definitely OCD or definitely borderline autistic or whatever the fuck it is. You know, I don't know. But that's just, you know, that's kind of the way I've always approached everything.
Sure.
Like, methodically and by watching and doing, and then trying to look to do it better.
It's interesting that you've put so many parallels between painting and cooking. Because my next question is actually along the lines of, Thai food is not the first thing you've been really into. Like, rock climbing, music, like, you've had other loves, and I'm sure these still have some presence in your life. I mean, have those creative endeavors played any influence on your style and your culinary work?
Yeah, I would say almost certainly there's a certain amount of, you know, I mean, go to the restaurants. There's a certain amount of kind of punk rock attitude about it. You know, it's like there's not a lot of frills. I'm more about form than more about function than form. I think that's a lot of what punk was. It was like stand and deliver, like fucking song. All we need is three chords and turn it up loud and go. You know, while there's not an exact direct correlation to the way the restaurants turned out, there is some. It's like we don't need white tablecloths. We don't need mahogany tabletops. All we need are plastic tablecloths, melamine plates. But by God, the food that we put on it and the drink that we put in our, you know, bomb-proof glasses is going to be really delicious and really, really well thought out. That's the important thing. We're going to give really good service, but we're going to wear T-shirts.
Yeah.
We're going to make really delicious food. We're going to put it on that's ethically sourced, that's everything's, you know, made by hand. We're not pulling anything out of cans or anything. But we're going to put it on these cheap things, and we're going to, you know, we're going to make the spaces look evocative, but we're not going to, like, spend a ton of money on a design. I've never hired a designer in my life
okay.
a restaurant. I know some designers, but, they don't work on my restaurants. I think there's a certain amount of crossover there from my musical ethos and the way I've approached
Love that. Well, I've got a couple more questions for this first half of the interview. You have a new book out now, The Drinking Food of Thailand. And this is not your first endeavor in doing a cookbook. This is actually your second one.
The second cookbook, yeah.
I'm curious. Tell our listeners a little bit about, you know, the new book and maybe some of the things you were hoping to accomplish with this one that you hadn't with the first cookbook, Pok Pok.
Sure. So this book is about Ahan Gap Khem, or the drinking food of Thailand, which is kind of what the Whiskey Soda Lounge is all about. It's food that's typically eaten while you're drinking in Thailand. To me, that's kind of one of my favorite ways of eating food in Thailand, is just go somewhere that's got a limited menu of kind of snacky foods, and you kind of hang out, have some drinks, and it's very social, and it's very fun. The food tends to be kind of chewy and crunchy and salty and spicy and sour, bitter, strong flavors. I've always loved eating like that, you know, just kind of small bits of this and that. The way we approached the book was to, instead of... like with Pok Pok, we had all these recipes that I had developed over time, right? That were part, you know, it wasn't not just Thai food. You know, Pok Pok isn't just food from Thailand. It's food from, you know, Southeast Asia. There's food from Vietnam. But this was specifically about drinking food of Thailand. And most of the drinking is done at night. Most of it, not all of it. So I wanted the look of the book to be evocative of that vibe. So we shot everything in the field. At the various places where you drink and eat. And we shot them at night. We shot it with hard flash, kind of like a Terry Richardson style shot. You know how he's...
trying to remember who you're talking about.
He's a fashion photographer. Okay. He's got a terrible reputation as, like, you know, just a not a cool person.
Got
as
it.
Far as, like, the way he treats other people. But he's iconic in the fashion world because he did this whole thing with a, you know, point-and-shoot camera with a flash on it. Bland. That was his aesthetic. And there's also the old kind of crime scene photography from the 30s and 40s. And, you know, I just really loved that kind of, like, noirish vibe and kind of, like, that hard flash thing. So we went out, we shot all these dishes at the restaurants, just ordered it, arrived at the table, threw it on the table with all the beer and the napkins and the, you know, the cigarette butts that were there, and just blam, took a picture of the dish. Then we did the recipe later. So some of the dishes we, you know, I already had recipes for. We just had to kind of alter them a little bit so they match what the photo looked like. Some of them I had to start completely from scratch. So that was the way we approached this book. So it was a bit of a discovery journey for me as well, like looking for new and interesting things. Whereas the Pok Pok cookbook was like, well, that's the experience of the last 15 years or longer of like working on this shit,
you know, yeah,
distilling it. So there's another music correlation, right? It's the debut album of a band comes out, and it's what they've been working on since they started. You know,
yeah,
they've been working, unless they're really lucky and really talented. They, you know, they've been working on this shit for, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, and they get the first record out, and it's the best stuff they've got. And it distilled down, like, oh, this is what we got, and then they got to make another one.
Yeah.
And usually that one is music they've been working on for just a couple of years, right? Because they've given all their best stuff for the first one.
Yeah.
So, you know, they either kill it or they don't, you know?
Yeah.
So this is the second book, and I couldn't just go back and like, pull stuff out of Pok Pok anymore.
Sure.
You know, we'd rely on what we'd done at Whiskey Soda Lounge. Had to find some new stuff, too, because to be honest with you, I didn't have enough recipes to make a whole cookbook when we started out. And it was great. I learned a bunch of new stuff coming out of this. Some of my favorite recipes in the book are the new things. There's a correlation with the musician thing too. You know,
sure.
Guys going out there and they're like, come on, man, play Ike's Vietnamese Fish Sauce Wings. You're like, nah, I've played that a million times. I want to play Sequel.
Another good parallel right
there. Nam, right? this is my favorite new song. I know you don't know it yet, but you're going to like it someday too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. So are you the type of guy that tends to say the first album a band does is always their best?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
I mean, some people... Spoon, for instance, right? Those guys, their first record, I didn't care for it at all. But at some point, I feel like Britt Daniels went down to the crossroads and made a deal with the devil, because somewhere in the middle of their career, and now it's earlier in their career, but all of a sudden, those couple of records came out. It's like series of sneaks.
Yeah.
And then, like, Girls Can Tell and a couple of those came out. It was just like, holy shit. Dude just kind of, like, had some kind of epiphany or made a deal with the devil and just suddenly started producing these insane records, you know? So absolutely not. But history is littered with people who have, you know, either done, you know, their first record and then faded to nothing or died. Nick Drake.
Yeah.
Or restaurants that, you know, the first one comes out and it's fantastic and somebody, and then they open another one and it just kind of doesn't do as well.
Well, I'm sure we're going to talk about music a little more in round two. And you're certainly someone that has not faded out after restaurant one. The proof is in in the pudding there.
I don't know. We've had our successes. We had our failures.
Sure.
You know, I've closed several restaurants.
Right? Mm-hmm. But you're still growing.
We're still in the game. I say we because I don't do this by myself. Got over 200 employees and a big operations team, and it's everybody kind of does what they do. It's not just me.
Definitely. Well, more questions to come around too to wrap this one up. I feel like it would be cliche to ask you if you ever thought you'd get to this point in your career with everything you've built up with Pock, having been on Travel Media, everything you have going. But rather, what I'd like to ask is, what's surprised you the most over this decade-plus career of building up the Pock empire, for lack of a better word?
What's been surprising? Like, nothing surprises me anymore, I don't think. It's so much weird shit has happened, and you know, good stuff and weird stuff. I never thought that restaurants would become such a huge part of the American psyche right now. It's just, there's millions and millions of restaurants that they've become kind of like the millennial form of entertainment. Yeah. Go out at night. It's your whole night.
Yeah.
Even before that, the Gen X people were already starting with that stuff. But it's like, you know, Portland, I saw an article online that said 101 notable restaurants open in Portland so far. And that was like 2 months ago.
Yeah.
Right? We're not even at the end of the year. It's like 9 months into it.
Wow.
There's already over 100 new restaurants that have opened in Portland.
It's no secret Portland is a big restaurant hub
in
the country, especially for a mid-sized city.
Yeah. But, you know, and yes, it is. But, you know, you go to any market where there's a booming economy and restaurants are proliferating like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's interesting. It's also not sustainable.
Yeah.
unless the economy does some kind of crazy jet towards the stratosphere.
Towards infinity,
And like housing prices drop. You know, I don't know. But yeah, I think that's been the most surprising thing to me is they haven't stopped opening restaurants yet.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It is pretty wild. And round two will be wild as well. For those of you listening, we're going to take a quick break. We will be right back. Whenever you're ready, I'll jump back in. I'm going to share a quick story, too, because this is technically not the first time you and I have met.
Oh, really?
And it probably doesn't stick out to you or not, because this was just over Twitter and whatnot, but I'd mentioned I was over in Thailand once, and I was in Chiang Mai, and I was trying to find all the restaurants that you and Bourdain went to. And that's a lot harder to do in real life than it is, like, as it appeared on the TV show. So I tweeted at you, I'm like, Andy, I can't find any of these spots. And you kind of laughed at me. You're like, ha, that shit's not as easy in real life as it looks like on TV, is it? And you're like, just follow my Instagram account. Like, that's back when it had the map feature.
Yeah.
You can look for it there. So that was...
If you go to his website, they actually have it all there. We sent pin drops, too. I'm not sure. I haven't looked at it for a while, but...
Your pin drops were what got me everywhere I needed to go. You know, I guess one question I have is, I'm sure when you started the restaurants, you didn't think you'd have Vice making a documentary about you.
No.
You probably didn't imagine being on a show with Anthony Bourdain, and I'm sure plenty of other experiences that I'm not aware of. Do any of those stick out, or what's kind of been the most enthralling out of all those extracurriculars that you've done?
I don't know. While doing that kind of thing can be fun, it's also work. I mean, I think it's important that people understand that what you see on TV is not what is happening in front of the camera.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, you do a podcast, and you know that podcast, and you know that you're going to go back and you're going to edit this.
Yeah.
And you're going to make it look cool, and there's probably going to be some music inserted here and there, and you're going to pick the best stuff out of this, and you're going to make it fit a certain time format.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to try to edit it so it has a certain trajectory and a
path. It's like you've listened to this show before.
Well, no, I understand how the show works. So a TV show is the same thing. It looks like the Bourdain show looks like we're just sitting there randomly in this distillery somewhere on the side of the, and we get wasted, and then we go and do all this other stuff.
Yeah.
Well, you know, first there was, you know, weeks of work getting the locations picked out.
Yep.
The in-country fixer having to go and arrange to do all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the production company writing a script that they may or may not use. And then everybody had to come. The talent has to show up, Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
I'm already there for, you know, a week before he shows up. And then the filming took a week, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a week's worth of wake up at 7 in the morning, go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Do a shot, wait for 4 hours, 3 hours, go to another location, do another shot, run through it again. Didn't get that. Let's run through that again.
Yeah.
And then you walk away from it not knowing what it's going to look like. Mm-hmm. No idea, because Tony's a very, like, very eloquent. Mm-hmm. Usually he says what he has to say, and they don't have to get him to say it again.
Sure.
If they do make him say it again, he doesn't say it exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. But it still works. You know, they've got this incredibly talented editing team and music composer that goes through, and they make something out of it. Mm-hmm. But it's just, it's kind of like starting with a basket full of vegetables and ending up with a stew. Like, mm-hmm. You know, you go to the market and you buy a bunch of fucking vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to make a stew, right?
Yeah.
So,
yep.
That's what TV is like. It's seldom glamorous in the moment. I mean, it's great to meet people. Like,
yeah.
Like getting to hang out with Tony, it was
yeah.
awesome. He's a good guy. But it's like, you know, honestly, his job isn't to hang out with the guest.
Yeah.
His job is to do his job.
Yeah.
This is his job.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, after the shooting is done, he gets in the van and he's gone, you know?
Yep.
And so it wasn't like we hung out for a week and told each other our deepest secrets or anything like that. It was, we were doing a job.
Yeah, you were creating content.
And he's a good guy. And I feel like each other. There's respect and stuff like
sure.
that. But, like, I've never been to his house. He's never been to my house.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, anyway, all this to say that it's all work, right?
Yeah.
And some of it's more interesting, and some of it is very good for business.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to any chef who does this kind of stuff. And most people who are focused on their business view doing TV as something that helps their business.
Mm-hmm.
Some people turn the corner, and that becomes their business.
Yeah.
Being on TV is what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And they end up making a living in front of it. But the vast mm-hmm. majority of people, chefs, restaurateurs, who appear on these things, do this because A, it's fun. It's a good distraction from what you're doing. Change is as good as a rest.
Mm-hmm.
B, you get to meet somebody that you think is cool. But C, most importantly, it helps your business.
Yeah.
It does. Like, Pock was on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives.
Okay. I haven't seen that one.
It's probably one of the best things that's ever happened to the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we went from selling, you know, 35 orders or 40 orders of wings a day to selling, you know, 230, 240 mm-hmm. in one restaurant.
Wow.
So, and it was, I've got to hand it to Guy Fieri, I think. Being on that show, you know, we just started selling chicken wings like nobody's fucking business.
Yeah.
And say what you want about the guy. When he shows up at your restaurant, something happens.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And he knows it,
mm-hmm.
and he's cool about it. He's, you know, look, you know, he says, I know, you know, after we leave, there's going to be a lot of people coming here.
Mm-hmm.
So just be ready for it. He's actually, you know, he's a very hardworking guy. He's got lots mm-hmm. of charities. Super hardworking. Very talented guy. You know, the optics are a little bit difficult for some folks. But,
yeah.
You know.
he gets an unnecessarily bad rap. I mean,
yeah,
I live in Northern California, and he's not too far from there. When the fires were going on
in
Santa Rosa.
He's out there feeding people barbecue.
Exactly.
He's very, very in tune with that kind of stuff. And so it's like people would say, why would you go and, like, be on that show with that douchebag? And it's like, look, man, first of all, that guy works way harder than you do.
Yeah.
Or ever will do.
Yeah.
Second of all, you'd be an idiot not to.
Yeah.
Because as soon as, if he likes the place, and you know on TV whether he likes it or not,
yep.
if he likes it, all his followers go. Everybody mm-hmm. likes that show.
Yeah.
They do. Like, you talk to people, they're just kind of like, yeah, I don't know about guy, but you watch the show, it's a good show.
Yeah. No, I was a bartender at a place not too unlike this one back in college, and when I had to work Monday nights, and when no one was there, I would pop that show on and just, like, binge watch Diners, mm-hmm. Drive-Ins, and Dives.
Sure. So, you know, all those experiences have been, for the most part, pretty good. A couple mm-hmm. of them have been shitty, but, you know, for the most part, it's good. And mm-hmm. it's part of my job. It's my job to make sure that I do whatever I can to ensure that the restaurants get business
yeah.
in a very competitive industry in a very competitive environment, because I've got a lot of employees that have been with us for a long time. Some people have mortgages,
mm-hmm.
children, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I need to make a living. It's part of the job at this point. So nothing like has been like, wow, that was a life-changing experience.
Sure.
But it's all been interesting. I've also had just like really interesting time learning how to change a fucking P-trap in a sink.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
it's an equally important part of the job.
Mm-hmm.
Learning rudimentary plumbing,
yeah,
you know, really important.
Well, I like kind of how you put it in perspective, that it's not all the glitz and the glamour that goes in it. To your credit, you guys did make Northern Thailand look really cool in that episode.
They did, yeah. All I did was lead them to the spots, and they made them look cool. Very talented crew.
Well, it looks like a good drinking story at the end of the day, and that's actually my next question for you. I always like to ask a drinking story to help our audience get to know the guest a little better, so Do you have one you'd be willing to share?
Sure. I mean, I think this is a story that I relate in the new book, uh-huh. Drinking Food of Thailand, and it was it's kind of how it's in the foreword of the book. You know, our first one to Thailand was 1980. Like I think it was 87. I'd have mm-hmm. to go back and search through my last two passports to find out.
Sure. Like when time number one was.
I think it was 87. I'm not sure. I flew into Singapore. And I made my way up through Malaysia, mm-hmm. and I came across the border by train, basically, mm-hmm. from Kuala Lumpur, or maybe by bus to the border and then by train. Anyway, I came across the border of Malaysia into southern Thailand, mm-hmm. got on a train, and headed straight for the islands, because mm-hmm. that was kind of, you know, at the time, I had my little lonely planet, Southeast Asia, on a shoestring, which mm-hmm. was kind of like what, you know, everybody, there was no internet at all, mm-hmm. So guidebooks was how you got around. Mm-hmm. So I got myself to Koh Phangan, Koh Samui, Koh Tao, that kind of area. Basically, ended up on Koh Samui, which is the biggest island there.
Yep.
And I was like, you know, I really, you know, I want to get a little bit further off the beaten track. Now, at the time, mm-hmm. Koh Samui was a beach resort already, but it was basically a place where all the buildings were made out of bamboo, mm-hmm. right? There were no concrete towers. Mm-hmm. But I was like, fuck it, I want to go a little further off base. So I went to Koh Phangan, which is where they have the full moon parties. Mm-hmm. And actually, there was a full moon party the first time I was there, but it was, you know, it was just a bunch of hippies dancing around on the beach.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything like it is now. At some point, I like lost a contact lens or I broke my glasses or something.
Okay.
And I had to go back to the mainland to get a new contact lens. And the city that you go to from there is either Surat Thani or Champon. And mm-hmm. Champon, you can get to Surat Thani, you go by the standard ferry, it takes you back to the mainland. It's kind of a bigger city. Or you can go to Champon by coconut boat. Because mm-hmm. at the time Koh Phangan and Koh Tao were coconut plantations.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the coconut boat to Champon.
Mm-hmm.
As a side note, as I was traveling across, I was laying on a big bag of coconuts and like some dude kind of taps and he goes, "Hey mate, you got a scorpion on your head." And I just put my head forward and this giant scorpion, like,
holy
like that
smokes.
Big fell off the top of my head, and the guy like leaped on it with his flip-flop and killed it.
Wow.
So I made it to the mainland in one piece without a scorpion bite on my head.
That is good.
And I went to the only optician in uh-huh. Champon, and, you know, they didn't have my contact lenses, so I had to go to Bangkok. And, I wasn't rich, so I couldn't really get the fast luxury, there weren't that many of these anyway, but mm-hmm. there was like the air conditioned express bus, or there was local bus.
Mm-hmm.
The express bus cost 180 baht and the local bus cost 65 baht to Bangkok, mm-hmm. right? So a few bucks. So I took the local bus and it was full of these, you know, guys. There's a lot of itinerant workers
mm-hmm.
that work down there and go back to Bangkok, or vice versa. They're fishermen that were heading into the big city to visit relatives or buy food or whatever. So anyway, there was a group of fishermen there on the bus, or maybe they were just going up to the next city. It was a local bus. It stopped in every town. They were driving. You got about 100 kilometers north, and these guys, you know, sitting next to me, and I was in this tiny bench seats where like four Thai people would sit,
mm-hmm.
and with like 4 inches of leg room, and I was just kind of jammed into this seat.
Yeah.
And these guys were drinking. They were drinking Mekong whiskey, which is the local government. It's actually rum, but it's like a government-produced cheap local booze. And Lipo Witan, which is a Red Bull precursor. It's mm-hmm. one of the original energy drinks. So they were drinking shitty whiskey and shitty energy drink, and
yeah.
they're like, "Hey, you, come over." And they said, drink, and so I started drinking with them.
Uh-huh.
And it was great. Like, this is my first sort of like interaction with Thai people outside of the context of like going to a bungalow or talking to a cab driver on
sure.
a train,
yeah,
or, you know, in a place that catered to backpackers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like my first real taste of true Thai culture. You know, it was kind of like the deal was, they couldn't speak English at all.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't speak Thai at all.
Mm-hmm.
But we were having a great time, you know. And at some point, they signaled to the bus driver that they had to stop, you know. And the bus stopped, and they kind of made motions they were going outside to take a piss. So
mm-hmm.
I was like, yeah, I got to go too. So, like, they got up to go, and I got up to go. And, like, I'm as tall now as I was then, you know,
uh-huh.
6'2" or whatever it was.
Okay.
Tall white dude on the bus. So I was already standing out like
yeah.
a sore thumb. But I went up to go outside and take a piss on the side of the road. The bus just erupted in laughter.
Oh, okay.
And you know, farang, farang, just really, like, it was hilarious.
And what does that word mean? Just
foreigner, basically.
Foreigner, yeah. Okay.
Farang. Not, they don't call, like, Korean people farang. Konkauli. Westerners, basically, it's farang.
Got it, okay.
And you know, I got off and, we all took a piss on this, and everybody's laughing, fishermen are laughing. I'm like, got back, and then we got back on the bus and we continued on. That was my first experience of, like, drinking with local folks.
Cool. That is a good story. Got some rapid fire questions for you as well. Some of these might still be on the same lines. You just told us about your drinking experience in Thailand. What is a drinking or culinary experience everyone should have in Thailand?
Basically, you should just go and be fearless and just eat whatever's putting in front of you. That's what you should do. I don't have any specific thing you should do. It's all interesting. It's all good. Somebody offers you something, eat it.
What's your favorite word in the Thai language?
Ugh. It's not a word. It's just something they say. That people say. It's like, when it's like going, uh-huh. They go, mm-hmm. I love it.
All right. Best punk rock band.
Best punk rock band.
Or any band. You can have some freedom with that.
Yeah, so like for me, I probably love Richard Hell and the Voidoids. I guess that's kind of post-punk. Yeah.
Okay, so what era were they most active?
It's 70s. So, contemporaries with Television and Blondie and that kind of thing. But you never heard of Richard Hell and the Voidoids?
I've heard of them. I'd be lying if I told you I knew any more about them.
Look up a song called Love Comes in Spurts.
All right. I'll take an action item from this interview. What are you uncommonly good at after you've had a drink or two?
Belching.
All right. Very, very natural. So last one. What would you be doing today if you weren't running Pock Pock?
Tugboat captain.
All right. Have you done that before?
No.
Okay. So it's like a dream job still.
Yeah, it's like a fantasy job. It's not even a dream. I don't even think I really want to do it.
All right. Yeah. What's one question that I didn't ask that you wish I would have?
What's your sign?
What is your sign?
Rutabaga.
Rutabaga.
Yeah.
That's not like a typical...
No, it's unusual, yeah.
Well, we're towards the end of the interview, so I've just got a couple more wrap-up questions for you. We know you got the new book out, Drinking Food of Thailand. I will have links to that for those of you listening in the show notes. What else is next for Andy Ricker?
Well, right after this, I'm going up the street to do a cooking demo for some folks. And then, I'm going to be heading off to Thailand on Christmas Day.
All right.
For 2 months to get back with my cat and my girlfriend and cat's girlfriend in the house. Go back home.
Well, I know you do go over to Thailand quite a bit, and I think that's reflected in the type of work and the way you're continually able to iterate on what you're doing and just kind of keep what you're doing over here in North America in check with everything that you do. So I appreciate all the research that you put in. And
I mean, I should put a plug in, actually. What we're working on right now is the next cookbook. There's a noodle book coming.
Oh, all right. Awesome.
That'll be another year out. But what project am I working on? That'll be the project.
Cool. And I know we're here hanging out at Reel 'Em In right now. What are three or four other spots that people should check out if they're in Portland?
For drinking?
Drinking or food, whichever sticks out. Obviously, Pock Pock.
This is a pubcast, so let's stick to the drinking.
All right, we'll
side
stick to drinking.
So Pepe Le Moco, my favorite little... it's a bar in the basement of the Ace Hotel.
Okay.
Jeffrey Morgenthaler, great bartender.
Okay.
Fantastic cocktail bar. I love that place. Love to go drinking there. You should check out the Woodsman Tavern if you like whiskey. Really great whiskey selection and really good food. Very, very good food. And you're going to wake up in the morning after you've been drinking. You got to have some breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
So you better go to Han Viel Sandwich, which is a Vietnamese deli cum soup noodle place.
That is good hangover food.
Opens at 7:30 in the morning, I believe. 7 or 7:30 in the morning. And you can get a bowl of really, like, the best Vietnamese noodles in the city for breakfast.
So. Awesome.
Or you can get a banh mi.
Also a good choice. Usually my standard at a Vietnamese restaurant.
Yeah. Also, you're going to have to get some coffee. We got an embarrassment of good coffee shops here.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite is the original Stumptown Cafe, the one that started it all on Division Street, just up the street here. Great coffee. Still the best, in my opinion.
No, Stumptown is a go-to. It's usually what I do right when I land in PDX every time I come through town. And then what's the best way to connect with you and Pock Pock?
Best way to connect is there's the Instagram and Facebook stuff. So you can follow me on Pock Crua, at Pock Crua, on Twitter and on Instagram. We also have Pock Pock PDX is probably a general good at in Twitter and Instagram. Also Facebook. Our website, pockpockrestaurants.com. That's a good way to connect. That'll connect you to everything.
Awesome. Well, for those of you that do follow that, get ready for plenty of pictures of awesome Thai cuisine as well as awesome cats as well. So that's it for me today, Andy. I appreciate you joining. One last cheers.
All right, cheers.
Thanks so much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure.
And for those of you listening, we'll catch you again next time.
Hey, thanks for listening. As a little bit of a shout out to Mr. Ricker, that was his favorite group, Richard Hell and the Voidoids, taking care of the music this week. It was a lot of fun having Andy on today's show, and as a quick mention here at the end, I do want to give him one last plug for his new book, The Drinking Food of Thailand. You can find that at bookstores, Amazon, wherever you grab your books. Make sure to check that out. Finally, I'd love to hear what you thought about today's episode. I'm not going to lie, I was really excited about this one. Andy Ricker has been a bucket list guest of mine for a while, and he has certainly influenced some of my own personal food and drinking travels. So I want to hear what you guys thought. Head on over to pubcastworldwide.com to leave a comment on the show notes page for this episode. While you're there, don't forget to sign up for our monthly e-newsletter. And until next time, stay thirsty, and we will see you again back here soon. Cheers!